Got
Oh,
it.
you did it. All right. Well, welcome back, everyone. Grateful to be with you as we continue on this conversation about the realities of mental health and what it means to encounter stress in our lives, and specifically what it means to deal with trauma. And though I know that for many of you who are in the Zoom now, and I know for people honestly who will be watching this later, that's a buzzword for you. And so we're going to talk through some of the elements of trauma. I have some questions that were sent in through OIS, and I will engage in those as best as I can. And in anything that I don't answer here and you've got questions about, again, you can either email me, reach out to me. We can talk through that a different time. The truth is, we're not going to be able to tackle everything in this session when it comes to trauma. It's too comprehensive. It's too big. Probably later on down the road, we could do another three-part series just on trauma and understanding the impact of trauma, the different elements of trauma. But we're gonna get things kicked off here, and I would like to walk through just some overview stuff. And if you were with us for our previous session, or you watched our previous session on stress, we talked about good stress and bad stress. There are three types of stress. There's good stress, there's bad stress, and there's toxic stress. Toxic stress is essentially any stress that in the moment overwhelms our ability to cope. Toxic stress is when the chemicals that are produced during stressful experiences become so overwhelming that they are toxic to the brain. So cortisol, which I'm sure many of you have heard of at some point before, cortisol is a stress chemical that is produced in our bodies when we are under duress or distress. Cortisol is necessary for regulating. It is also necessary for helping us realize, or our bodies realize, that there's a situation that we need to pay attention to. It essentially tells our brain and our body, hey, we need to have alertness, focus, and energy right now for our survival. In small doses, cortisol is really, really good. In large doses, cortisol is really, really bad. High levels of cortisol can shrink the prefrontal lobes by 20 to 25%, and that is permanent neurological damage. Once those brain cells are diminished, once that toxicity encounters in the brain, those cells are no longer responsive. It's as if they don't exist anymore. And though that is a reality, there are ways of working through traumatic experiences or toxic stress, and our brains are forming new neural pathways all the time. So you can, in fact, teach an old dog new tricks. But there are some realities that go along with that. The brain doesn't, once you've encountered highly traumatic situations, the brain just doesn't work the same way. It just doesn't. About 25% of individuals who go through an event that registers as trauma, and I'll talk about that here in a minute, exhibit signs of what is called post-traumatic stress. Here's what I do want to tell you, and it's really important. 75% of individuals who go through what is called post-traumatic experiences exhibit signs of post-traumatic growth. So only about 25% of individuals who have gone through events that are highly traumatic show signs and symptoms of PTS. Most people who go through traumatic situations, and we all have, show signs of growth. So trauma doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. It's just a reality that we encounter. What we do with it, how we grow from it, what we move on from in it with, that is what I want to talk about here with you today. What I want to start with, though, is that this is how I define trauma, because I get this one a lot. This is how I define trauma when I talk with individuals. It is a type of stress that comes from an experience that leaves us in a state of hurt, horror, hopelessness, and powerlessness. Let me say those again. A stress that comes from any situation or experience that leaves us in a state of hurt, horror, hopelessness, and powerlessness. So essentially, anytime that we're in a stressful situation and that stress exceeds our ability to cope in the moment, that's going to make us feel hopeless or powerless. It's going to make us feel like we're overwhelmed beyond our capacity. And if that lasts for too long, stress levels build up in the brain, cortisol levels build up, and we then, in fact, move into a state of what would be called trauma. And one person's event doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be traumatic for another person. So the example I like to use is moving. I'm going to just ask the question here kind of as I pull through, and it's helpful if any of you raise your hand, either, you know, Dave, you're watching with the camera on, which is great. I love seeing your face. But have any of you ever moved before? I have. I moved. Dave's moved. Kyle, I'm sure you've moved. I don't know, Stephen, I don't know if you've moved. But did you know that Aaron, okay, yep. Did you know that moving is as traumatic for some children as their parents going through a divorce? The moving from space to space, moving from home to home, location to location, never having a place to call your own or leaving one room. It doesn't matter if you've ever moved before, you know that there are some things that just don't make the move. There's a toy, there's a game, there's a favorite shirt. Something gets boxed up and gets thrown away or gets left. We lose things that we love. Moving can be really traumatic for children. Now, some people love moving. They love the thrill of moving. They love to be in a new space. They enjoy all of that. And so one event for an individual that could be traumatic doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be traumatic for another person. And that's because every brain is different. Our home of origin is different. Our personalities are different. And so much of that factors into what we register as trauma. Also, our level of support is different. Some people, I met with somebody today, someone today in my office who is going through a divorce and working through multiple affairs with their spouse. They have been through a world of crap. Now, I don't know if I would register that as a traumatic experience, and here's why. Because this person has a ton of support. They've got a ton of people around them. They're going through all the right steps. They're going to go through counseling. It's why they're meeting with me. And it is yet to be determined whether or not we would register that as trauma or just a stress that they've gone through and they have the ability to cope through it. Now, if something else happens, let's say a loved one gets sick, and all of a sudden what was manageable is no longer manageable in that situation, it could turn into toxic stress. And we wouldn't be able to define, well, which event was the catalyst for this trauma. We would just say, no, it's an overwhelming sense of stress that learned that moved beyond the ability to cope. And now here we are, we're in the stress chemicals and the stress hormones, and we would call this toxic stress, or we would call it trauma. The same thing is true for, and I'm sure for those of you who recall event that you went through in the military, whatever the event was. Last year, I sat with a young man who was retired Special Forces Army, did three tours, two in Iraq, one in Afghanistan. He saw some, can I say shit? He saw some shit. Okay. And he had parts of his body rebuilt because of what he encountered. And honestly, he saw people die right in front of him. There were moments where that was overwhelming for him. There were moments where that was That's just too much. And here's what I want to tell you. One, if me saying that triggers something in you of a past event or memory, there's a really good chance that you have gone through something that we would call trauma, that we would call toxic stress. You may have not noticed it or realized it in the moment. You may have not been aware of it in the moment. But now looking back, if I even my words saying that make you recall a memory of something like that, it's burned into your brain. And it was probably an event that would be registered as trauma for you. And just real quick here, I'm gonna share my screen so that I'm gonna pull up a whiteboard here. Can everybody see this whiteboard? Yep. We got nine people following me. Look, 10 people following me. Look at this. I'm pulling up this whiteboard here. And I just want to say that this is your brain. Okay? I know it doesn't look like your brain, but that's because I'm a therapist and I'm not an artist. And there are essentially for this conversation, there are three sections of the brain that I want to talk about. I want to talk about this section right here, which is the limbic system. And I want to talk about this section right here, which is the cortex, neocortex. And then I want to talk about this section here, which is the prefrontal cortex. Now, this little guy right here that I'm circling really, really big is called the amygdala. The limbic system is the part of your brain that is responsible for controlling all reaction, all emotions, all pleasant and unpleasant emotions. But basically, when you are triggered, when you are angry, when you're stressed out, when you are emotionally compromised, the limbic system is fully in charge, and that is what is going to produce what's called fight, flight, response. Also, fight, flight, freeze, fawn, find, fold. If you were listening to our conversation that we had two sessions ago in our first conversation on stress, I walked through those. But the limbic system is responsible for all that. It's the part of our body that is responsible for survival. The prefrontal cortex, well, this little guy is responsible for helping us be rational, reasonable, calm, logical. All of that kind of stuff. That's what we need to be, well, whatever, what would be called functioning tax-paying members of society. And the amygdala, that guy right there is the trigger man that moves us from the front to the limbic system. And once that amygdala has been triggered, it will look and hunt for signs and situations that are similar to keep us safe. Here's why that's important. Dave, can I call you Dave? Dave, if a bear walked into your house right now, I'm saying if, not it's gonna, but if a bear walked into your house, your amygdala would switch on and your limbic system would say, I gotta get the hell out of here because I don't want to get eaten by a bear. We need it. We need that part of our body and our brain to respond so that we can be safe. But if the prefrontal cortex engaged, you would say something like, huh, what kind of bear is that? Is that a grizzly bear? Is that a black bear? Is that a brown bear? Is this the kind of bear that I'm supposed to get big with, or the bear that I'm supposed to get small with? Like, what kind of bear is that? And by the time the prefrontal cortex started thinking through all of the scenarios, you'd be eaten. You'd be dead. There's a time and a place for the prefrontal cortex to work. There's a time and a place for the amygdala to kick in. There's a time and a place for the limbic system to kick in. All of that is the way that it's designed, the way that it's supposed to, ideally, so that we can survive. But let's say, Dave, that a bear did in fact walk into your house. And a week from now, let's say you survived, and a week from now, you heard a creak at the door. Your amygdala would be hunting for signs or evidence that there would be another bear around the corner, and it would trigger a reaction from you just because of a sound. So this is where triggers come into play with our trauma, because all of us have had trauma and all of us are triggered. The reason I say all of us have had trauma is because every single human being, even civilians, go through overwhelming, stressful experiences that exceed their ability to cope at some time. And we all encounter some level of toxic stress, whether it's a divorce or a move or a breakup or a stressful experience at work, or we are in an accident or we are in combat. We've all gone through it. In fact, any of us who, and I'll walk through this here in a minute and some of the signs, any of us who went through the COVID-19 pandemic went through global trauma. Every single human being was traumatized in some way. In fact, I can prove it to you, because all you need to do is walk in somewhere and say vaccine in an open room and someone will get up and walk out. Like, you don't even need to say which vaccine, just say, hey, you should get vaccinated, and someone will probably give you the middle finger and walk out. They were traumatized. They would never say that, but they had some sort of emotional reaction to that. Here's where the trauma triggers come in, and here's why triggers are so important. Just like if we heard a sound outside and our brain was telling us there might be a bear out there and you need to be careful. If you've been through a combat experience or you've been through some sort of painful event, and you in your life moving forward are in a situation where there's even a hint of a possibility that it could be similar in some way, even if the circumstances are completely different, you might be triggered. Well, how does that play out? Well, I had a teacher in middle school who fought in the Vietnam conflict. And when he heard loud noises, even a book, in fact, there were some kids who did this once, and it was not in one of my classes, but it was in my grade level. There were some kids who used to, they would, just for fun, they would take a large book and they would drop it on the floor so it made a loud bang, and he would instinctively jump underneath his desk. Now, kids are stupid and they didn't know what they were doing. And thankfully, he had enough grace to tolerate it, but he had trauma triggers because he had been through intense combat, mortar fire. Same thing, trauma triggers, like if you've had post-traumatic experiences with fireworks, things like that. But it doesn't have to be limited to that. It could be any situation that in some way reminds you. Could be a smell, could be a sound, could be something that you see. In fact, our brain responds to the dominant senses. And so we'll walk through some things that you can do here in a minute to help through that. But our brains walk through the dominant senses. They work through dominant senses. So if we see something, hear something, taste something, smell something, it can trigger us just like that. And the reason why I bring all of that up is to say that you have, if you've been through a trauma or you've experienced toxic stress, your brain never, never forgets it. And you cannot avoid being triggered. You're going to be triggered. And so it's, what do you do with it once it happens? And this gets into, someone wrote in a question about the book, The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk, which is recommended reading, in my opinion, for anybody who's alive. So that's everybody. Everybody should read it. The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk. He is the leading researcher, leading authority on trauma. He wrote that book years ago, and it was his way of essentially saying our bodies physically hold on to the memories of the past, and we are constantly carrying the stress of what we've gone through. And your body keeps the score. Your body will remember far faster than your brain will. And if you are, in fact, working through something that was really hard in your past, there's a really good chance you're going to be triggered again, multiple times, possibly daily. And the problem with a lot of what I've talked through with clients when it comes to trauma is we We think that, we just need to avoid situations where things like that are likely to happen again. It doesn't necessarily have to be connected. Again, I was talking with somebody a couple months ago who lost a loved one. And this is where it gets crazy. His loved one was a brother, and he was driving down the road and he saw a road sign that made him think about his brother. And he had to pull over because he was so emotionally overwhelmed that he couldn't drive anymore. That's just a road sign. It had nothing to do with his brother, but it triggered a memory, which then entered into his brain. And there he was. He was totally reactive and incapable of moving forward in that moment. And here's what I want to say about that situation. And here's what I want to say to you. That is okay. It's okay. Honestly, we don't have a context for a lot of the memories that we've gone through that are really hard. And when we're triggered, the biggest thing to do is be aware of it and give it the dignity it deserves. If you lost somebody, or you went through intense stress or intense combat, and it was really hard and it was scary, and you may not have said it in the moment, but you were scared, you're hurting, and you go through something in life that reminds you of that moment, can you just give that moment the dignity it deserves? Like, that was hard. And you made it. And maybe some other people didn't. And that's tough. And to try to just say, well, I'll just wish that away, or I'll just go to therapy and that won't happen anymore. I'm just going to tell you that's not the case. You're probably going to have that happen again. And it's not okay that it happened, but it's okay that you remember it and you feel badly about it. Oftentimes we try to fake it till we make it. And I just want to ask you, how's that working for you? Most of the people that wind up in my office, they are tired of faking it till they make it, because you know what? They can't fake it and they don't make it. And so you need to talk about it. You need to address it. You need to sit in it. And the big thing is give it the dignity it deserves. Man, something hard happened. The last thing you want to do is pretend that you're okay when you're not. And as we just like think through some of the realities of traumas, so I've talked about some of the chemicals and some of the things that happen and all of that. I just want to walk through some examples of toxic stress with you. And by the way, everything that I've said, both in the good stress, bad stress, and now toxic stress, that's all in a Word document that I sent to Pam, and she can make that available to you. This is just stuff that I've written down and I've lectured on before, or I've taught on before. Let me go through the list. Just this is not a comprehensive list, but this is a list of what would be considered traumatic events or examples of toxic stress. A sudden or tragic loss or accident, car accident, someone dies. A friend of mine from high school, her mom was diagnosed with cancer and gone in less than 4 weeks. Crazy. Tragic loss, no time to really wrap your mind around it. Physical abuse is an example of toxic stress. Oh, I should say, by the way, let me just pause here a second. If anything that I say here triggers you in any way, I apologize in advance. I'm not doing this carelessly. I'm doing this with as much compassion as I can muster. And so if you get triggered, I'm so sorry. I don't mean to trigger you, but I do want to talk about these things. Sexual abuse is what is considered to be a toxic stress. Very few individuals, very few can go through unscathed. Emotional abuse. That's a harder one to pinpoint, but if you've been emotionally abused, and I work with people who have, that is a toxic stress. Physical neglect, emotional neglect, exposure or experience to or with intense mental illness. So if you know anybody in your life that you're close to that has chronic depression or chronic anxiety, or they have bipolar disorder, or they show signs and symptoms of other mental health illness issues, that is, in fact, a toxic stress or can be a traumatic experience. Exposure to or experience with divorce, either someone you know, your parents got divorced, or a close family friend or a family member, or if you got divorced, are just telling you that is usually, that usually results in some sort of toxic stress. Exposure or experience to or with substance abuse. So if you know people who are struggling with addiction, that's actually considered a traumatic event. And if you've ever lived with an alcoholic, you know why. Because it totally puts you in a place where you're unsafe and you feel powerless and you feel hurt. And you go through that long enough, that's going to be the case. If you're coping with your trauma with alcohol, that's actually a double trauma. And so there's a lot of danger that comes along with some of those substances. Prolonged exposure or experience to or with debilitating or life-threatening illness. My dad has Parkinson's. He's in end stage. He will not be with us very, very long. We don't know when, but at some point he won't be able to do things like swallow or eat. And then it's only a matter of time. And my mom is his sole caregiver, and she's exhausted. Like, this is a toxic stress for her, caring for him. And that's just reality. Prolonged exposure or experience to anything that I've talked about. When you, if you're in a relationship with someone who is caring for a loved one and their loved one is sick, and so they're experiencing toxic stress, the longer you're with them, the more likely you are to exhibit signs and symptoms of the same kind of stress, which effectively is called vicarious trauma. So there's trauma that we immediately go through, and then there's the trauma that we take on when we're in a relationship with someone who has gone through trauma. And so for those of us who interact with other vets who have gone through trauma, we have to watch out for the signs and symptoms of vicarious trauma, which is where we take on the trauma that they took on. You can only spend so much time interacting with people who have gone through profound hurt until you start to show signs and symptoms of the same kind of hurt. Our souls are connected. We have things called mirror neurons, which is where our brain processes through situations that other people are going through. And so we take on a part of their pain. If you have deep empathy, you're in danger of compassion fatigue or vicarious trauma. So it's just really careful. And here's the sorry, excuse me. Here's the last one I'll talk about: prolonged loss of agency. So I mentioned Bessel van der Kolk. He is the one who wrote The Body Keeps the Score. Bessel van der Kolk talks about something called agency. Any of you sports people? Anybody? I'm a sports guy, a little bit. I watch some sports with my son. I don't know a whole lot, but anybody ever heard of a free agent? Okay. A free agent is somebody who gets to make, they're like, you don't own me. You don't tell me what to do. I'm the boss of me. Well, effectively, every human being likes to believe that they're a free agent. We like to believe that nobody tells us what to do. We like to believe that we have a choice in how we live our lives. You don't own me. I get to decide. I'm the boss of me, all that kind of stuff. What Bessel van der Kolk found in his research is that people who go through what is considered to be a prolonged loss of agency, where you go through a long period of time where you are not fully in control of your life and you have to do what somebody else tells you to do for a long time, they find that that effectively equates to trauma on the mind, body, and soul. So let's just say hypothetically, not a stretch, but let's just say hypothetically that every person watching this Zoom session went through approximately a 12-month period or 12-week period in their life at some point, 3 months, where somebody else essentially told them what to do every single day. told them what to wear, told them when to wake up, told them what they could eat, told them where to go. And then after they graduated from such experience, then they, quote unquote, enlisted into a career in which someone told them where to go, told them what to do, told them what to eat, told them all the things that they needed to do, and barked orders at them, and then potentially put them in a situation where they were in tense combat. And they saw some shit. And then, quote unquote, graduate from that experience and move into civilian life, where they don't have the same routine, they don't have the same structure, they don't have the same camaraderie, and they feel out of control. And let's just say, for all intents and purposes, that happens to occur between 2020 and 2024, and the world falls to shit. And it's crazy, and people are telling you, I don't know where you can go and where you can't, who you can talk to and who you can't, what you have to wear, do you have to be 6 feet away, you have to get vaccinated, or you can't go to your job, or all of a sudden people are just barking orders at you all the time. It sounds like a good hypothetical scenario for, I don't know, some sort of trauma. I'm of the opinion, for those listening, for those watching, I'm of the opinion that at some point in your military career, you encountered some form of toxic stress. Nobody gets out unscathed. They just don't. Some more than others. And as I mentioned, just because it was a toxic stress event doesn't necessarily mean you're going to show symptoms of post-traumatic stress. You may show symptoms and signs of post-traumatic growth. Like, you made it. You're stronger because of it. You're better because of it. But it's still a traumatic event, and it's still something that can trigger you. And now, for those of you, and I do want to honor, some of you asked some questions, and so I want to go through that. And we have some time to unpack some things, and I do want to get into some of the things you can do about it. But I think this is a really good time to answer some of the questions. So one of the questions is, I'm too tired and depressed right now to do almost anything. Then I get more depressed and sleep and eat more. I know what my problem is, and I cannot get motivated to do much of anything. Have to sleep now and try to get motivated to handle and handle anything. And so the first thing here is, one, it could be that your level of stress has been so high for so long that it has now turned into depression, which you probably know already if you're watching or listening. And if it is, in fact, depression, I want to tell you that what you're experiencing is a normal response to an abnormal set of stress. You are not broken. You're not broken. Your brain and your body are responding just like they should. You can only ride the stress roller coaster for so long. And honestly, between the month of September and se September and February, maybe March, depending on where you live in Michigan, if you live in Michigan, you may not see the sun as much. And so you might have seasonal affect on top of it, seasonal depression on top of it. And if that's the case, then I think, first of all, being aware of the fact that you are depressed is really important. Seeing a counselor, really important. You may need medication. But I by the way, I am not for or against medication. I believe that some chemical realities in the brain can be addressed and adjusted by the right medical conversation. And so, one, like, good on you for recognizing it. Two, simple things like eat, sleep, and exercise are a big deal. The three things that I work on with most of my clients, especially those who are working through depression, is, at a minimum, make sure that you're eating, and not McDonald's. And be careful of coffee, by the way. Just be careful of any stimulants. But make sure that you're eating. Yeah, Red Bull is not good for you. David is not good for you. It's poison in your body. I'm just saying. It's a big old cup of stress right there. But be careful with what you take in, especially if you're depressed. Because it's like putting napalm on a raging fire. It's just not good. Oh, Steven, you got a question? Can you turn your
So,
mic on, Steve?
3 pots of coffee a day is not good.
No, so if you didn't get a chance to listen to my previous episode, 1 cup of coffee, 1 cup of regular coffee increases the level of cortisol in a woman's brain and body to be toxic for 24 hours.
Man, this sucks because I gave up smoking. I don't really drink much. My wife won't let me have a girlfriend. The only thing I got left is coffee.
Well, I did. I was telling Kyle earlier, I switched to tea almost exclusively in January. I don't drink coffee anymore. Every once in a while, if we're on vacation, I have a latte. And you know what's really interesting? When I have that latte and I have that when I have actually like the intense coffee from an espresso bean, I can feel my stress levels rise in about an hour. I get anxious, I get jittery, I'm irritable. And I've noticed there's a huge difference when I eliminate caffeine. Caffeine, incidentally, is the only psychotropic drug that is not regulated by the FDA.
Man, see, I have the opposite. When I have a good cup of strong, bold coffee, I'm in my happy place.
Well, now it could also be that your body is holding on to sense memory and you enjoy the warmth and the flavor and all of that. All I'm saying is just if you're not careful, it will increase your stress levels to toxic amounts. And I'm clients that I work with that are going through acute anxiety or depression, I just tell them to be really careful with alcohol as a depressant. Be really, really careful with caffeine. And I got to say this too, because this is a new thing now. It used to be that marijuana was illegal. Now it's not. For those of you listening in, and I apologize if this feels like a little bit of a soapbox conversation, but I'll just say it out loud. Tetrahydrocannabinol, which is the chemical THC that's found in marijuana, that is a hallucinogen. It's a hallucinogen. It's not an upper or a downer. It actually does crazy shit to your brain. And if you are anxious or depressed, I have had clients go into panic-induced episodes because they had a gummy. Just you have to be so careful with stimulants. But all that to say. All that to say, eat, sleep, exercise. Three things that you can do for your mental health every single day. Do something for your mind, body, and soul every single day. Make sure you're getting enough sleep. What they've found right now is if you're not getting 7 to 10 hours of sleep a night, you're causing your body to be inflamed. Inflammation leads to poor mental health regulation. Inflammation also leads to cancer, they found. So not getting enough sleep can actually be carcinogenic to your body. And so making sure you're getting enough sleep. It's okay if you oversleep, actually. That's your body trying to tell you something. Maybe, just maybe, your body is compensating for its stress by sleeping, which is that's okay. I mean, if you have a lack of motivation, at a minimum, try to get 20 to 30 minutes of just walking outside. If you can go somewhere where there's birds, the science has actually proven that if you can listen to birds and be outside in nature, it decreases your symptoms of stress and anxiety. So that's really, really good for you. That's really, really helpful. The other thing that you want to be really aware of is that when you're processing through depression, having a source of connection with other people is really important. You don't need to have a bunch of people, but have one friend that you talk to, one friend that you text with, write with. Make sure somebody knows something. Incidentally, the most dangerous time for people who are in major depressive episodes is when they're starting to come out of it. People who are contemplating suicide are most likely to attempt suicide, not when they're in the thick of depression, but when they're coming out of it. When they start to experience a little bit of hope, that's when they're most likely. And so if you know people who are struggling with depression or you're struggling with depression, make sure you have people around you when you start to feel a little bit better who can help hold you accountable and that you're in connection with. So that's addressing that first comment there. Another one, thoughts on the book, The Body Keeps the Score. How's the VA is addressing trauma? Here's the deal, friends. I actually don't know how the VA is addressing trauma. I don't know how they're addressing things like The Body Keeps the Score. Partly because I don't work for the VA. And so I don't have a ton of connection. I've talked with a few individuals. The VA is overwhelmed, and they don't, these are too nuanced. As I mentioned, one person's trauma is not necessarily the same for somebody else. And so there's no real playbook for how to handle every single trauma. And you probably know this better than I do, but when you go into the VA, they'll ask you questions. They may even give you medication, but you're not probably going to sit down with a therapist for 50 minutes every week. You're probably not. And what we have found in research is that the best way to heal from trauma is actually in the context of a safe confessing community. When you're around other people who have been through what you've been through, everybody feels safe and they're able to talk about and process through what they've gone through and their experiences. That's actually what shows the most growth and the best way to heal from those traumatic experiences. And sometimes the VA can provide some support groups, and sometimes they can't. Again, a lot of it just depends on your proximity, the amount of time that you can put in. Most of us have jobs, and it's hard for us to get away. Sometimes we have jobs that are filled with people who are understanding of what we've gone through. Most of us, man, if we've gone through some shit and people don't know what we've gone through, it might be hard for them to connect in some way. And so, and then they got to figure out like their own stuff too. And I have found, and you probably found this too, most people who don't get it, they just say the dumbest things. They just say the dumbest things. They say things like, oh, just pray about it more. Oh, just trust in God more. Well, you know what? Hey, by the way, I'm a pastor. So I pray a lot. And I'm a therapist. And I can tell you there are some types of stress that prayer just doesn't seem to help with. And that's not to say that prayer doesn't work. But it, one of the primary symptoms of trauma and stress is that you have trouble connecting with a higher power. Did you know that? Like stress actually blocks our ability to connect with a higher power in meaningful ways. So saying something like, hey, just pray about it, it's probably not going to help. It's probably not. So when people say things like that, or this is my favorite one, well, just don't think about that. Just don't think about that. You know what's really funny? Not thinking about something actually causes the neural connections in the brain to grow five times larger than normal. So, in essence, by not thinking about it, you're reinforcing the fact that you are thinking about it five times more than normal. So it actually makes it worse. So that's a big one too. It's just don't think about that. Or you know, just talk about it. Well, it's not about talking with anyone. It's about talking with somebody specifically. And talking with the right people that you feel safe with and that you can trust. And those people can be hard to find, even in community groups, because trust is pretty sacred. So I will say I will say that let's see, that kind of gets to the other question here of conflict with family or dealing with people who don't believe my story and think I should be in a mental hospital. Well, I don't know if any of you have ever seen the movie Men in Black. There's this great line by Tommy Lee Jones where he says to Will Smith's character, he says, "Hey, a person is smart, but people are stupid." And I know this sounds so negative, but you have to embrace the reality that some people are stupid and they just don't get it. And they probably never will. And I, at least for me, I've found over time that if I can accept that, then it gives me empathy and compassion in the moment. I don't have to be reactive and I don't have to prove to them about what I went through. The truth is, they've probably never gone through anything that is making them feel that way. And until they do, they'll never really understand. They never will. And you don't have to be angry about that. It's just a reality. With family, it's really tough. I want to, if I guess, you're not crazy. You're not crazy. And you're not broken. Your brain is doing exactly what it's designed to do. It is reacting to previous threats, and it's trying to keep you safe. When those responses kick in, you need to be able to respond to them differently so that those responses don't dictate your behavior. You're not broken. You just need some new tools and some new skills so you have a different response system. So here's a couple of things. One, we talked about this in our stress episode, but I'll say it again. Breathing. Deep diaphragmatic breathing, 2 to 5 minutes, in through your nose, out through your mouth. I prefer box breathing because it's a great visualization tool. Breathing is awesome for dealing with a stress response and dealing with those moments where you have a trauma trigger. I'm holding on to, I don't know if you can see this or not, but I got a little orange squishy. I love squishies. Anything like this, any tactile, things that fidgets, they call them. There's something about these squishies, these kind that you can squeeze, these little stress balls that actually make the front of the brain and the back of the brain talk together without having to use words. They're really, really good for regulation, really good for calming. You can get them for $5 on Amazon. In fact, Pam, I can send you the link, but this is called a Needo, NEEDOH. They're a really good squishy. They're really, really good. And I buy them like 5, 6 at a time, and I give them to clients when they come in. Most of my clients will get one or two of these when I'm sitting with them in session, just so they can have a squishy to hold on to while we talk. So things like that are really, really good. Squishies, breathing, going for a walk in nature, being around trees, really, really good. Meeting with a therapist, people, friends, if I could, finding a really good counselor. They don't have to be the best at trauma. I mean, that's the big thing. It's like, well, I need to find someone who's a trauma expert. You might not, to be honest. You might just need somebody safe to talk to, who's skilled in asking the right questions. Sometimes some of the deeper trauma work, and we can talk about that a little bit too. There are some methods that people walk through. There's some stuff that people do with sounds or flashing lights. That's called EMDR. There are some strategies that are clinically proven to be effective. My only problem with clinically proven trials is that those are the ones that we know of because people have gone through the hoops of testing clinically proven studies. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're more effective than talk therapy or something else. Sometimes just having someone who will listen, who knows how to ask questions and is safe is sufficient to help curb some of the symptoms that you're seeing. Is it good to talk about your previous experiences? Yes, in the right setting, when you're with a professional or a safe group, so you're not inadvertently or inappropriately reliving through past events that you don't have the skills to work through yet. You just have to be really careful about who you talk to. Because I don't know about you, but I do know some individuals who have been through highly painful experiences, and they basically just tell everybody what they've been through when they first meet them. They can't, it's like they can't stop themselves. That's one, evidence that they haven't worked through the process. Two, then you say stuff and you risk saying things out loud that you wish you could take back and you can't. And then you feel like an idiot. And then you tell yourself a shame story of, I shouldn't have said that. I shouldn't have done that. I said the wrong thing. All of it. Just be really careful about who you share with and realize, as I mentioned, a lot of this stuff takes time. Like years to work through. My goal with clients is that in a 6 month period, they're 10% better. 10% better. ain't nobody get to the full 100. And the ones that do too quick, I'm worried if it'll stick. Because I want long-term change. And if you can get 10% better in 6 months, and then another 10% better in 6 months, and then 10% better in 6 months, and Steve, I'll pick on you just because it looks like you're in law enforcement. I'm just throwing it out there. Are you in law enforcement, Steve?
I retired 32 years in it. Now I work for the gas company with
Okay,
Kyle.
so you were in law enforcement. Let me just ask you, if the crime rate in your city decreased by 10% every 6 months, would that not be amazing?
That'd be awesome.
You'd be on national news, and in 6 years, you'd be out of a job.
I'd be okay.
So, what I tell clients is the same thing. If you saw 10% growth and reduction in your symptoms in 6 months, and then another 10% 6 months after that. Well, after a couple of years, that's 40%. And that's good. That's real good. In fact, I'll argue 10% is usually sufficient to save a marriage. Usually sufficient to lose your stress levels that you had. Usually sufficient to keep you going. 10%, that's all you really need. And so I think having a realistic understanding of what growth looks like and what change looks like is super, super helpful. And I'll throw this in too, partly because I'm a pastor, not partly, because I am a pastor and I believe in it. Though I did say you might not be able to pray away your trauma, which is true. Probably won't be able to. What research has found is that people who engage with a loving God through prayer and connection in the church. There's a study that came out in 2016 that gave this information, but they found that those people were, on the whole, experienced 50% less stress symptoms than those who did not. So engaging with spirituality, engaging with faith, reading Bible, praying, having a connectedness to a loving God, finding a support group, support system in the church, those all play a factor in healing. Now, you can find healing without those. I'll be honest, you can. Because I know people who don't engage in faith and don't engage in church and they find healing from pain. But you're going to experience overall a better outcome incorporating some sort of faith and prayer into your healing process. So let's see. We have about 4 minutes left. I'm just going through the chat here. Is it possible to go through the post-traumatic growth and post-traumatic stress at the same time after a single event? Can the growth be short-term and the stress long-term? Yes, the answer is yes. It can be short-term and long-term. The stress can also be short term and the growth can be long term. And Kyle, that goes a little bit to what I was saying about 10% better. I mean, the stress can be, you can see a decrease in your reaction or reactivity, and you can see an increase in your growth and your productivity if you're willing to walk through things like when you're triggered, going through breathing. I usually find they go hand in hand. I just think the reason why I say 75% of people experience post-traumatic growth is because most people who have gone through traumatic events, most people who have gone through traumatic events will tell you they grew from it. They grew from it. And we tend to focus on the negative of post-traumatic stress. What I want to say is that we can also focus on the positive, a lot of it has to do with your mindset and the way that you view it. Listen, the fact that you went through something hard is a reality. You can't change that. But it doesn't necessarily have to dictate how your life operates. It doesn't. You can talk about it, you can work through it, and when you talk about it, when you work through it, when you find the proper paths for healing, you can actually grow from it and become a stronger, better individual because of it. So, yeah. So that, I think that's a good place. We got about 5 minutes left, and I'm happy to field some questions if people actually want to say something. or talk about it a little bit here. We've got about 5 minutes for questions.
Josh, I have a question. I'll open up a bit. So you talked a little bit about the mirror effect. I don't remember what words you used as far as, listening to other people that have gone through, trauma. Do you find, or is that common for people that fall into that to have a hard time saying no to listening to trauma? Because I think as a veteran, I find the camaraderie that I have with some of the team and some of the people that I've met, our connection deepens with the sharing of that trauma. I think it's a safe space, but is there a time where it's too much, where you should say no and say, you know what, I today is just not a good day to go through the trauma with you, because I find that happens to me quite a bit.
Well, when you have a connection and a bond, it's harder to have boundaries, but that's actually where boundaries become the most important. It is okay to say, no, today's not a good day. And yes, it is harder to say no to someone when you've shared a deep emotional experience. Similar to Stockholm syndrome, if you've heard about that at all, you can Google it, but it essentially, when you live in close proximity to someone who is going through something hard or you're going through a traumatic experience, you can tend to identify with that individual. And it's hard to separate who you are from who they are. Years ago, there was a group of civilians that were held hostage by terrorists. And because of their prolonged exposure and traumatic experiences, they started to, for their survival, identify with their captors. And when they were rescued, they were indistinguishable from the people who had held them hostage. The civilians were essentially fighting on behalf of the terrorists. And though I'm reluctant to say that your people who are talking to you about their trauma are terrorists, I'm not saying that. I am saying that when you spend a lot of time closely connected to someone who's hurting, it's hard to separate who you are from who they are. And so the answer is yes. And that's why I say you really need to have, in that kind of group setting, you need to have someone who is aware of that to be able to say, hey, we're going to pause there. We're going to pause there. That's a great place for us to stop. Or, hey, let's talk about that next time.
Thanks, Josh.
I think Brené Brown said it best. She said, boundaries are essentially our avenue for unlimited compassion. If we have good boundaries, we can be compassionate all day long. You can swim in that water all day long. But if you are not well bounded, you're going to burn out. And then you're no good to anybody. So let's see. We have another thing pop up in the chat here. Aaron McDowell, Semper Fi, man. Semper Gumby, I believe, is the appropriate term. Correct? Always flexible and always faithful, but Semper Gumby. Let's see, Scott Torello, I got your question here. Do you or have you worked with someone who has a close friend or coworker to share experiences but have a harder time sharing with their spouse? Dude, everybody I work with has trouble talking to their spouse about this stuff. Everybody. In fact, it is almost a given that men are more likely to talk to a counselor than they are their spouse. Almost a given. And part of that has to do with vulnerability and intimacy. The other part of it has to do with feeling bad because deep down inside, you don't want to burden your spouse. But here's the danger, Scott. Most spouses will say, I just want you to open up. I just want you to share. But I don't want to burden you. I don't want to make you feel bad. But then they feel bad because you're not opening up and you're not sharing. And it's this vicious circle. And then you get this whole thing of like, I'm a bad husband because I can't talk to my wife. Or I'm a bad wife because I can't talk to my husband. Then you get this own shame story that you're telling yourself. And the whole thing's a hot mess. You know, most of the time in couples counseling and stuff that I do, it's really about giving couples an avenue to talk. Scott, I typically ask, couples to get a journal and not talk about it, but write about it instead. Because a journal is less threatening. And I don't know about you, Scott. Maybe you're asking a hypothetical for a friend of a friend and you're not really asking for yourself. But a lot of times when we do open up to our spouse, they'll start asking us questions, which is really scary. And then we feel like we're being interrogated. And when you feel like you're being interrogated, you shut down, because most of us don't know how to ask questions in helpful ways or helpful ways. And so getting a journal allows for space and time and reflection and contemplation. And so, yeah, I guess in short answer, the answer is yes. See it all the time. Overwhelmingly, what I work through with couples in marriage counseling. But especially with trauma situations, you really should have a journal that you work through, because it's just too hard. It's too deep, and you need to give people space and time to respond. And even if you just write it and you pass it back and forth, but usually giving people, 8 to 24 hours to respond and then come back. And don't do it over text message. That's not helpful. Don't do it over email. Don't get the same context. Get a journal with your spouse. Also, great time for me to plug my app, Kyle. I developed an app for mental health, that is essentially a digital worry journal that allows for you to enter in how you're feeling and what you're working through. Plus, there's practices, built in, breathing exercises, gratitude practices, mindfulness practices. And it actually gives you the capacity to share the work that you do session by session with a loved one, a spouse or a coworker, a boss, a colleague, someone that you trust, people in your support group, pastor, therapist. The app is called the WorryWork app. And I said this on a previous channel or previous time, but anybody who's a part of or affiliated with OIS gets a free subscription to that app. It's free to you. And so I just need to know whether you have an iPhone or an Android, and I can get you that info. So you can reach out to Kyle, you can reach out to Pam. They can give you my info, but things like that are super, super helpful. So, that's all we got. I know some of you got to take off and you're already leaving because you got meetings and stuff like that. So grateful for you. And again, if you have any questions, let me know. I will probably do something like this again with OIS. And so we'll come back to that. And if you've got questions or specifics, you want us to riff on something else, we're happy to do that. So grateful for you guys. And I'm going to sign off. So
Thank you,
peace.
Josh.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, Pam.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.